Welcome back to Understanding VC. Today, my guest is Joshua Agusta. Joshua is the director of venture fund in Mandiri Capital Indonesia, the corporate VC arm of Bank Mandiri, the largest corporate bank in Indonesia. He's responsible for leading fundraising and investment operations of Mandiri Capital's new venture fund vehicles. Prior to that, Joshua was a VP of investment in MDI Ventures, corporate VC arm of Telekom Indonesia. Besides investment activities, Joshua is also actively involved in industry and market research, where he has co-led MDI Ventures' two white paper publications. Now let's talk to him. So hi, Joshua. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Hey, Rahul. Good to see you.
So let's start with your background. Where did you grow up and what were your interests growing up?
Grew up in Jakarta, Indonesia, forever and has always been since the last 30 years. When I grew up, two things has been my biggest interest, sports and music. I played basketball back in high school, and I learned to play violin and piano since I was 4 years old. I started playing piano at 4. I started playing violin at 6. I stopped when I was 18, so it's been 12 years of learning how to play music. And actually, a side story is that one of the things that we consider for my profession post high school was to learn in one of the conservatory in Europe, actually, in Austria, for performing arts.
Nice.
Actually, so during my teenagers, when I grew up, I was so focused into that, building my skills, honing my skills to become a musician. But at the end of the day, we realized that that world is not for us, at least for me, right? Just because I think it's too fancy for working class people like us at that time. It's very difficult. I have a Chinese heritage. My mom and my dad would love me to actually continue their family business, our family business to start with. So they have never been like super supportive of myself being a musician. As you know, in Asian countries, Indonesia included, it's very, very difficult to become a very, very successful musician, especially if you are learning classical music, right? It's very hard to sustain yourself doing that. So eventually I decided not to do that. So yeah,
that's
basically the story of...
So, but a lot of Chinese parents teach their kids classical music, right?
Indeed. Yeah. I don't really mean to be like super stereotypical, but the Chinese parents, they see their kids as like quote-unquote trophy. So FYI, when I was in high school, junior high school and elementary school, I have like extracurricular activities and courses like every day, like Monday to Saturday, actually. There's math, there's English, there's Chinese language, there's the music, what have you, right? So I think their kids is our parents' way to brag, quote unquote, when they meet their relatives, their friends, and what have you. And the amount of courses or their performance at school, for example, are the things that they like to brag about when they're meeting their relatives. So that's the way they did it back then. Right now, we can use our Instagram and brag, right? It's quite easy for us, the baby, the millennials and Gen Z. But back then, I don't think it's that simple.
Yeah. What did you study in college then?
I started actually business management. So I was in the Faculty of Economics in University of Indonesia. So we have like multiple specializations. So there's the business administration major. I picked the marketing management, actually. Yeah.
And how did you end up in VC?
So that's the interesting story. So actually, by serendipity, what I can say is that when I choose to work to the first VC firm that I joined in, which is Sistek Group, one of the first VC companies in Indonesia back in 2013, it was not by choice, actually. It's not the career that I choose when I was in college. Like, I want to be a venture capitalist or fund manager, because back then, no one understand about this in Indonesia, right? So the story was, I was working in one of the multinational FMCG companies in Indonesia, one of the largest one. So there's a stereotype again in my college that if you graduated with the, I think the distinction or something like that, if you graduated cum laude, the best thing that can happen to you is to work to this MNC FMCG companies. And this is 2013. Yeah, so there's no Gojek, there's no the high-paying unicorns today that we have in Indo, right? So FMCG is still the thing, especially for management student like me. So I applied for the internship there, and post the internship, they offered me the job, essentially. But during my internship years, I don't really enjoy actually working there that much, just because A lot of people around me are saying that because I was in their brand building department, we have like a soy sauce product to sell, and they were saying that you really like want to sell soy sauce for the rest of your life, something like that, right? I don't know if that's a good influence, but I was like triggered by that, and you know, I was asking myself, do you really want to do this for the rest of your life, right? And the one that actually said that to me was the CEO of Systech Group. We have engaged for several years, acting before my graduation since 2011, 2012. Nico, his name is Nico Wijaya, who actually, you know, also the founder of MDI post Systech Group, right? But essentially, you know, we caught up a lot during that years post my graduation back in 2013, when I eventually, you know, decided that, you know, I won't pursue my career in the FMCG company. You know, I went to him and said that, you know, what are you doing right now? How's Systech doing? I don't know what Systech was, right? I mean, and I don't think that Nico also knew what they tried to do back then, because still new, right? Something unknown. I mean, he just mentioned that we invested in multiple companies. You know, we tried to build companies from really small, becoming profitable, scaling them up, blah, blah, blah. Just not really sure what to do back then. I don't really have a job either, but just thinking that this guy is interesting and what they're trying to do is also interesting. He preached about venture capital, VC, he preached about Sequoia, BlackRock, the, you know, Treacherous Eight, whatever, right? Seeing those inspirations, I just think that, okay, maybe I should learn from this. I don't know what it is, but let's just give it a go, right? So yeah, I joined that Systech Group back in 2013. That's the first VC that I joined in. And that's the story of how I become a venture capitalist, I guess. It's not by design, it's by serendipity until today.
You've also told me you guys have missed out on investing in Tokopedia and Bookalapak. Could you share that story with me?
No. I mean, you know, again, back then, it's a state where we don't know what we don't know, or we didn't know what we didn't know back then, right? So when you invest based on unknown realms or by your own guts or intuition, I mean, intuition is built, right, over time from experience, from pattern recognition, what have you. You haven't met the good ones. I mean, we haven't made any successful investments prior to the company was born, or we haven't met the best of the best founders back then. Because again, there's no good founders. There's no benchmark back then. If you think about it, 2013, right? So yeah. No, we didn't know what we didn't know. So when William, the founder of Tokopedia, came in, then the comment was, Tokopedia, that's such a silly name. Don't you think? It's like a Wikipedia, but for toko, toko meaning store, right, in Bahasa Indonesia. So are you trying to build like Wikipedia for stores in Indonesia or something like that? That's a comment, right? I mean, it's so stupid. And Bukalapak eventually came to our office, the founder, just, we didn't even want to meet them just because back then the founders are not essentially look like a proper businessman, because I think he was like fresh out of graduation from college, things like that. You know, he's just a small kid. We don't want to deal with small kids in our business, right? I mean, we're a serious fund manager, serious money. We would like to invest to hotshot founder or something like that. But essentially, that's where we, looking back, our thesis for successful founders was wrong, right? I mean, we have choices. Like, there's a founder, you know, they have a property. There are two types of property startups, for example, coming in to us. So one founder A, they have like, he has like experience like maybe 20 plus years working in property industry, right? A very well-known broker in Jakarta back at the time. The other founder has no property management experience, what have you. He is a Stanford grad, an ex-venture capitalist. He knows how to write software, right? That's company B. Company A valued themselves at $2 million. Company B valued themselves at $20 million. Then as noob as we are, we pick, hey, company A is better, you know, more experienced founder, cheaper price, right? Why not? Eventually, company A died long time ago. Company B turns to Urbanindo, which is bought by 99.co. So back then, the premise, you know, again, we didn't know what we didn't know. Our premise was all wrong. So that was the some failure stories, I guess, that we can share.
Now that you have 7 to 8 years of experience, what do you think are some of the traits of great entrepreneurs? And it would be great, like, if you could share a story of like a great entrepreneur
Sure.
that you've met.
I think the basic one was they have vision, they have like not just the vision, but also the ability to communicate that vision to everyone around them, to investors, to their employees, basically to their key stakeholders. So that basically, they have like high obsession, like almost OCD, I must say, to their mission. One of the things that perhaps I must say on top of that is they have like a brain overdrive. So when people start doubting them, when people say that maybe they can't do this or they can't do that, multiple triggers, if they see that their main competitors are dying, something's like happening in their brain. Like they went into the overdrive mode and keep pushing like hard. So one of the stories that I can share is actually, I won't say the company name, but we invested into one of the BNPL company in Indonesia back in 2018. It was their Series B. And in Indonesia, I think the way the government, our regulators describe peer-to-peer license is quite funny. But if you want to have like to do fintech, essentially in lending space, you need the peer-to-peer license. So even though this is a BNPL company, they will also need the peer-to-peer license essentially to operate. Somehow, some way, the regulators back then, it's not the same guy as the one that we have today, but back then, didn't really like the founder of this company. I don't know why, for some reasons, but since they have built the company since 2015, 2016, they have managed good traction along the years, but on those 2 years of applying for license, they haven't really got that. They just registered, they're not getting the license until today, actually. So, but again, because he's like a very, very motivated, very, very obsessed founder to their mission, essentially he bought a multi-finance company and used the license for him to operate the company. And essentially built a subsidiary and applying that for the peer-to-peer license. And right now they got the peer-to-peer license as well. So they are operating with 2 licenses right now and operating 2 products, the BNPL product using the multi-finance license and also the productive lending from the peer-to-peer license. And right now they are $2 billion company. So that kind of overdrive, like when normal people like us, maybe, like, you know, when we see some obstacles, they'll say that, oh, you know, we cannot beat the regulators. I think we should just get back to square one and rethink what our proposition is. Because again, most of the successful startup founders are not normal by any means necessary. They have like different type of, I guess, brain or mindset. They keep pushing with certain motivations and being super resourceful to find their way. And that's what brings into this.
Usually startups fail when the founder gives up. Yeah. You know, before that, there's always always an opportunity.
Normal people will give up.
So, If you are out fundraising, in your opinion, what are some of the things that you need to consider, especially if you're fundraising in Indonesia?
I think first and foremost, I think before anyone do their fundraising, what they need to answer to themselves is actually to keep asking whether this is something that you want to do for the rest of your life, right? You know, if you're stuck in one job and one job only, is this job that you're currently doing and your company that you're trying to raise funds to is something that you want to do for the rest of your life, right? But because it's like, you know, fundraising is like marriage first and foremost, right? So it's going to be there for the rest of your life. So if you don't want to do that, I don't really think that fundraising for your company is a good idea. First place, right? Being an entrepreneur is lonely enough. I've never been an entrepreneur, but yeah, I've met a lot of entrepreneurs during my career, and you know, nobody said that, you know, being an entrepreneur is lovely, or you know, things that they like or whatever. I mean, all of them say that, you know, if I want to do, perhaps I don't want to do this again, right? Something like that, because it's too hard. You know, it's a lonely job. It's very difficult. A lot of uncertainties. And couple that with, demanding people who are giving their money to you, essentially, which is the investors, right? I mean, they're not giving free money. I mean, they're expecting something from it. So if you're not like totally committed to that, don't do that. Especially if you think that you want to raise money or raise funds just for namesake or for your ego. That's, I think, the worst idea possible. So I've met some founders who eventually, you know, if you dig deeper to their deepest motivation of fundraising and building companies to check some checkbox in their CV, essentially the bounty hunter type, quote unquote, you know, some of the founders are like that, at least the ones that I've met during the last 8 to 10 years, right? Which is, in my view, it's really bad. At the end of the day, you will just make your life harder, make other people's responsibility higher, and it's other people's money, right? You're responsible for that as well when you're fundraising. So yeah, I think those things that you need to consider before even you do that, before you're starting a company and do fundraising for your company.
Well, why should any startup raise funds from Andiri Capital specifically? It's a corporate venture capital, right?
So yeah.
And like who are the, what type of startups are you like looking at?
So for us, because we're, you know, the corporate arm of Bank Mandiri Group in Indonesia, and we are one of the largest financial institutions in Indonesia, what we're looking for is companies that can really support our existing business, which is mostly our financial services related companies, mostly fintech companies. Yeah, fintech companies in multiple stages in Indonesia, right? As long as they can build the synergies with Mandiri Group, then we're interested to invest to them. But essentially, what, talking from Mandiri Capital perspective, financial services is essentially a very regulated space in Indonesia, right? And if you have a fintech companies got invested or being used by the largest bank in Indo, which is for our regulators, yeah, they are like the quote unquote first class citizen, you will have the upper hand. And that's number one. Yeah. That's for, you know, building your market in Indo, right? Building your legitimacy in Indo. It's basically instant legitimacy for our regulators, it's legitimacy for your customers. That's number one. And I think number two, if you want to raise money from, you know, foreign money, big foreign money, you know, the development banks, big VCs of the world, the PEs, right? I think, again, if you are in a regulated space like fintech in Indonesia, unknown territory for most of them, being backed by one of the incumbents are like one of their maybe checklists, like give them some, you know, sense of comfort, like, oh, actually, they're being used by one of the incumbents, right? So maybe if they're being used by the incumbents and the larger one, maybe they're doing something right, right? It gives them, this foreign investors, this big money, some sense of comfort for their investments. So that, I think those two benefits that we can provide to our startups. We come in as strategic investors. We can always say ourselves as strategic investors in any round, right? And we can back our portfolio companies in multiple rounds as well. So we're not just one-off, right? When you're raising your next round, because we have the Evergreen Fund, we have multiple funds for our multiple purposes, we can always try to back our portfolio companies. And I think that also applies to other typical corporate VCs, especially the ones at least backed by SOE, Statoil Enterprise Indonesia, because we're like this big whole ecosystem backed by our government. We control, I think, the largest infrastructure, largest banking infrastructure, largest telco infrastructure in Indonesia, which can provide our startups some upper hand, both for, you know, market penetration, gaining more market share, market recognition, but also legitimacy from, you know, foreign investors.
External.
Yeah.
Okay. This is quite odd, right? It's not often that in countries, you know, a lot of public sector enterprise goes into venture capital. Why is that the case in Indonesia? I mean, there is also Bank Telecom with MDI, and then there is some Bank Mandiri with Mandiri Bank with Mandiri Capital.
I think, you know, MDI, Telkom started everything, right? Essentially, why MDI was built was not in the rationale of investing, first and foremost. So they have done the incubator program starting from 2012. Essentially, it was like a competition to find like the best solutions, the best tech keys, the best technologies, quote unquote, in Indonesia. They want to scale that up by building MDI, essentially. And it was built in notion of not gaining capital gains or investment gains, but more into like corporate innovation perspective. So one of the rationale that when MDI was built, the rationale was, oh, let's have a one entity under Telkom Group that can really bridge, you know, the legacy company of Telkom it is, you know, the big giant telecommunication company, and the new edge startup founders, startup technology companies, right? So MDI is like the bridge, essentially, to build the synergy, to build the corporate innovation culture, to essentially bring Telkom to the next level. That was the whole rationale. By you know, introducing Telkom to this new world of startups or technology companies in Indonesia, right? So that has been the rationale for Telkom. That has been the rationale for Mandiri Group as well to build their CPC. But I think the other thing that also important to note is that because these corporate venture capital companies are built under the state or enterprise umbrella to most of our leadership, basically the BODs of these SOEs. They only have maximum 6 years usually to be in charge, right? And they need to find, like, the demand for innovation is really high right now. So you will be perceived as a successful CEO or a successful BOD if you can bring like digital innovation or digital something to your legacy, right? And one of the fastest way to do that, because they have the capital ready in their balance sheet, is to build a corporate venture capital. It's a tangible way, right? I mean, nice. By doing that in the last, maybe you don't need 6 years to be able to build a tangible legacy, right? I mean, in 3 years, you can make like, I don't know, 15, 20 investments from a $100 million fund, which is fund, quote unquote, from your balance sheet, which is $100 million. It's like really small compared to the annual profit that they gain per year. And from that, you will get the instant tangible result, no matter what the return performance was, right? But it's a tangible result of building innovation culture, building innovation, you know, corporate innovation activities inside the group. So that's one of the ways that they, why I think the reason why most of these SOEs are building their own CVCs. But at the end of the day, the government decided that it's a maximum 5 CVCs. So right now we have 5 CVCs in the SOE, so there will be no more CVCs come up after this.
But I think it's still great that, you know, government is taking the initiative to incentivize the public sector enterprise to do this.
Indeed. At the end of the day, what we try to build is the innovation culture surrounding all the SOEs, not just the SOEs with CVC, but all other sector enterprises. And right now we're thinking about some of these SOEs are energy company, for example, oil and gas. Right now they're evolving to renewable energy, right? We have like, you know, shipping companies, one of the largest shipping companies in Indonesia, also an SOE, right? And we have right now multiple technologies, multiple startups to support their mission, essentially, to digitalize those processes, digitalize those businesses. So it's a very, very, I think, a very, very healthy ecosystem, very, very healthy learning process triggered by, you know, I think the building of MDI back in 2015.
Yeah, so I was reading, looking at your website, and then I see that you guys have an incubator program.
Mm.
And it's mentioned as an inclusive incubator program. What do you mean by inclusive incubator program?
So, yeah, the thing is that usually, at least in Indonesia, what we can see, the trend is that most investors, most VCs, they are essentially very, very attracted to invest into founders that have experience of going to school abroad, usually to the Ivy League schools, right? So sometimes what we see the trend is that there are not so many opportunities available for the good local graduates, for example, who are actually understand the market better because they stayed in the market, right? They understand the problem actually arguably much, much better, right? But they don't necessarily understand how to articulate their ideas, how to articulate their vision or their problems that they're seeing in the market, right? So seeing that trend, judging by that trend, I think what we're trying to do with the incubator program is to give everyone the basically an equal opportunity for them to be able to start company and scale them up, right? So I think that's what we meant by inclusivity, essentially. It's not just for a bunch of people who are going to, who are coming from the Ivy League schools, who have quote-unquote the privilege and the ability to articulate their ideas, but also quote-unquote to the underdogs. We like to invest in underdogs, so because most of them are unexpected, and you like to see unexpected things in the VC world, right?
Yeah.
That's why.
So you've been very vocal about Bukalapak IPO and the prices crashing and stuff like that. I read on Twitter. So what do you think of the IPO market currently in Indonesia?
It's a burgeoning trend that actually the IB companies are looking for tech deals, essentially, first and foremost. So for the last 10 years, everyone has realized Indonesia as the largest market in Southeast Asia. It's where to go, essentially, for any companies who would like to succeed in to be successful in Southeast Asia. They need to conquer Indonesia, blah, 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 and things like that. Indonesia has been like has that very strong narrative around it. But everyone is asking, where's the exit? You cannot really rely on M&A that much just because you cannot make that happen. You can only, quote unquote, pray for that to happen. You cannot control that. But the more controllable exit is IPO. So we need a healthy, like, IPO ecosystem, healthy capital market ecosystem in Indonesia. And for the last, I don't know, 5-6 years, what we have been facing is that the regulations are really strict, that it's almost impossible for tech companies who are mostly like asset light and hasn't reached their profitability yet to list themselves in Indonesia Stock Exchange. I think coming to, actually the movement started last year, but it happened like this year. Actually, our stock exchange has become more lenient toward digital startups or tech startups. For those companies who haven't reached their profitability, or for them who don't have like a tangible assets, they can also list themselves in Indonesia Stock Exchange, even though they are a different board, not the main board, but there's the development board, there's the acceleration board. You can basically pick what you want. There are some requirements for that, right? But essentially what our stock exchange is trying to do is to build a healthier ecosystem for startup exits to these IPOs, right? So that the startup can be an enduring company and they don't need to think about fundraising essentially after they are being listed in this public market. So I think the reason why I was so vocal about Bukalapak IPO, no matter what the price is that I think as a VC, as a private investor who are responsible in building this ecosystem, you are also responsible in building a healthy exit ecosystem, healthy IPO ecosystem as well. So I think as a VC, what you need to do is to not just seeing and not being fidgety about the prices. As a VC, we always see ourselves as long-term investors. Not so many VCs are doing that. But from our perspective, we need to be able to distinct ourselves and say that in the long term, it's gonna be much better for our economy, right? And it is. It already happened in different countries, in different markets. When you see Garena, when they see Group, when they list themselves in NYSE, I think they list themselves at 30 and they went back to 18 during the first 6 months and look where they are right now. Right? And I think similar things will happen with startups like Bukalapak, who has listed themselves in IDX and other unicorns in Indonesia that are going to come within next year or maybe next 2 years. Right? There will be a bunch more companies who already claim themselves to prepare themselves to list in Indonesia Stock Exchange, the likes of Goto, the likes of Traveloka and Blibli. And I think it will bring more benefits rather than liabilities for our market. And our job as a VC is to promote that.
Now, can the companies list in foreign exchanges? I mean, foreign stock market exchanges like NYSE or...
They can. I think one of the options that Grab took actually was to go SPAC in NASDAQ. I think same scenario with Redivo, also an Indonesian company. Right? They also went for the SPAC option. There's some discussions of perhaps for some of these unicorns to go dual listing, Indonesia and maybe US, something like that, but not essentially list themselves directly. I think it's quite difficult to list yourself directly. Different investors, different investor profile, different expectations, right? And when you list yourself directly, you will always be compared to the ones in their respective market, which is sometimes are not apple to apple, which is sometimes it can be good, but most of the time it doesn't really fit. It doesn't really fit your strategy. Sometimes it has a tendency of going bad if you list yourself correctly. So it's either through SPAC or dual listing, the options.
What is the state of VC in Indonesia right now?
So two things. The first one is there's a trend where the initial seed investor who are plenty back in the years, like 2013 and 2015, are currently raising larger funds, right? So if you take a look, like the players like Alpha, JWC, one of the major players in Indonesia, they raised $400 billion US dollar fund, one of the larger one in Indonesia right now. EC Ventures, they're closing a $200 million fund. I think the news came up a few days ago, right? So some of these seed players are moving to, I think, Series A, Series B growth stage as well. And with that much of funding that they have, they won't be investing into few hundred US dollar, 100K US dollar ticket size. So they will deploy like maybe 5-10 million US dollars per deal, right? Because of their fund size. So what's, in my opinion, because a few years ago, we have a Series B crunch, Series C crunch, whatever you, I don't really think we have that kind of problem at the moment. So our problem anymore, is actually the seed stage crunch, just because these earlier seed players are moving to the growth stage. So right now, interestingly, what we are seeing is that some of the founders who eventually got their exits from the growth stage, from the growth stage or from the IPO, from the acquisition, what have you, are starting to make angel investments to the seed, startups essentially, or pre-seed stage startups. But I think it's going to be healthier for the ecosystem if we have more seed funds, essentially seed funds or pre-seed funds. So for anyone out there who are aspired to be fund managers in Indonesia, I think Series A upwards is a bloodbath, but pre-seed is things to look at, in my opinion, just because not players out there at the moment. So that's the first one. And the second one, I think this is the effect of the larger funds coming in and the larger funds being raised by Indonesian fund managers, is that we can see like there are slight price inflation, right? So ticket size are growing like over time because the funds are getting larger and startups are raising more funds than they actually need. And there are not so many good startups anyway. So FYI, right? I mean, there have always been like maybe 5% best of the bunch, and then the rest are like, you know, mediocre to bad, right? So when all the big funds, all the smart money are trying to tackle the top 5%, there's going to be like, you know, price deflation. So prices are getting higher. Right now, we're seeing more commonly that, you know, Series A startups are raising 30, 40 million US dollars with 100 plus million dollar valuation. And startups is like 1.5 years old, right? So we're seeing the trend right now in Indonesia. So, and if we compare that to, let's say, similar startups coming from Thailand or coming from Vietnam, similar traction, we'll have like prices in Thailand and Vietnam, like only 30% of what we pay for Indonesian startups, right? Which is, you know, quite crazy, in my opinion. So I think in the future, at least in the short run, what's best for the market, and this is just my opinion, is we need a small correction happen. And the small correction can happen if the big, not necessarily big, but the growth stage startups, the one who has raised the Series B and Series C, who are backed by larger funds, with all due respect, mentioning that, you know, the folks like Tiger Global, the folks like Sequoia, the folks like Lightspeed, who are usually, you know, the driver of this increased price. Some companies who are being backed by them, who raise a huge amount of money, if they raise a down round, if they, you know, eventually didn't manage to survive or eventually went bankrupt or something happened to them and they went bust, there's going to be a correction. I think it's going to be better for the market in the short run. So yeah, I think that's just my opinion. I think we need this small correction to happen in Indonesia for us to be able to get our price getting back to normal.
Awesome. Yeah. Thank you so much for your time. This has been like a great conversation.
Okay. It's been fun, Raul. Thank you very much for inviting me.
If you like this podcast, please follow Understanding VC wherever you're listening to this, and also share it with folks who might be interested. Thank you.